I was biking to church yesterday morning on Cold Springs Road, and I passed a deer dead in the ditch. I bet many of you have seen it. On my bicycle, I can see a lot because I go slowly, because I'm right up close. I could see the blue-gray sheen in her eyes. I could see where she had bled. I wondered what would happen in a bicycle-deer collision. Actually, I don't think there would be a bicycle-deer collision. On a bike, we can turn on a dime. We can avoid the deer coming out of the woods. We can see more and adapt more quickly than we can in a car. Of course, if a deer and I collide when I'm on my bike, I bet I would get hurt more than the deer. I was biking to church yesterday morning so I could prepare this sermon, so I could figure out what to say to all of you in a week of murder and anger and fear and blame, a week in desperate need of hope and direction. And so here we come this morning to church to restore our faith and our purpose. I'd been thinking every day of last week about what I would preach, but then each day a new terrible thing would happen. And Saturday morning came, and I biked to church thinking about how much I can see from my bicycle. I can look people in the eye. We can see each other smile. I couldn't kill a deer with my bike. I'm gentle. So I started writing a sermon for you about how we could all live more gently, on a bike or not, but how we could look people in the eye as we move through this world. Live like we're on bikes, treading gently on this earth, moving with care. And then Philip called to tell me that after I'd left for church, our dog Oliver had run down our long drive. He'd never done that before. It's probably a third of a mile down to Cold Springs Road from where we live. But yesterday, Oliver ran down that driveway and onto Cold Springs Road for the first time. And as Philip was going down the drive to get him, he met our neighbor coming up with the terrible news that Oliver had been hit by a man driving a pickup truck, that he probably died instantly. Philip called and told me that, and there wasn't much else to say, but we stayed on the phone in silence while I could figure out how to use my feet again and figure out how to bike back home. And we buried Oliver up in the woods that he has loved in the 2 months we've lived here. When someone dies so fast, it doesn't seem real. It seems like there must be an undo button that we could push. I'm so sorry that most of you didn't get to meet Oliver. We loved him. We've loved a lot of dogs, but Oliver was truly exceptional. He was a champion frisbee catcher. He was a gold medal cuddler. Oliver made friends with everybody. He got my parents, who are farm people, not pet people, he got my parents to play with him. Oliver brought joy to our family, and we were counting on years and years more of that joy. So we wanted to rewind, to undo. I wanted that all last week, to undo Dallas, to undo Baton Rouge, to undo Falcon Heights. As we dug Oliver's grave, he was wrapped up in a sheet, but there were still flies all over him, all around him, scavengers like vultures and maggots that feast on death and decay, give us the creeps. I've heard white people say, five of ours for two of theirs, after those police were killed in Dallas. They're keeping score on some fantasy race war from their armchairs. Vultures swoop in to watch a dying animal. They tear into roadkill. They find satisfaction in another's death. It's their nature. They help this planet turn death into life. But when people do that, When people act like vultures and maggots in their armchairs, it is distorted nature. It is diseased nature. It is sin. Trucks and cars and guns, they're all weapons, even when we don't mean to kill with them. We make people wait until 16 and pass tests to drive a one-ton car weapon or a three-ton truck weapon. We know it's a risk, but a calculated risk, and we live with the 30,000 car-related deaths each year in this country. Even one death in a year is a tragedy to the people who love that one person. And yet we can also appreciate that in the last 50 years, the vehicle death rate in our country has been cut in half, thanks to seatbelts and safer vehicle design and stricter consequences for distracted driving. So now, at about 30,000 deaths per year, U.S. car-related deaths are about equal to U.S. gun-related deaths. Gun deaths have been on the rise. Trucks and cars and guns, they're all lethal, even when we don't mean to kill with them. Guns are weapons by nature, but trucks and cars are lethal too. Americans love our cars and our trucks, our interstate highways. We are people of the open road, romancing Route 66, and somehow we have adapted to safety features and legal restrictions regarding our vehicles. When will we agree to safety features on guns that will cut that death rate in half? So I wish we could hit the undo button on all of last week. But it wasn't just 1 week of killing, was it? It's been a month of killings that I wish we could undo. Ramadan ended last week. It's the holiest month of the year for Muslims. It's similar to our time of Lent. Muslims fast from sun up to sundown, then break their fast with a feast each night. Fasting through Ramadan or Lent, or any other spiritual fasting, is an opportunity for deeper prayer, for reaching toward God. And ISIS reminded the world how un-Muslim they are by calling for increased killing throughout Ramadan. If anyone claiming to be Christian called for a Lenten spree of murders, I trust we would doubt the sincerity of their Christianity. But countless people have killed in the name of Christianity, committed violence and abuse in the name of their faith. Ramadan's nightly feasts are the best of what breaking bread together can be. Families welcome each other with favorite dishes. They call out to strangers walking past to join them in the iftar, the nightly feast of Ramadan. When I lived in Minneapolis, Ramadan was a celebration across faiths, and local mosques made a point of inviting Christians and Jews and everyone else to join in these iftar feasts, to join them breaking bread. Our annual conference theme this year was beautifully Carry the Light. We celebrate with Andy Murray this morning a powerful invitation to brethren to carry the light of Christ into this world, which so aches for Christ's peace and love. And Ramadan reminds us that nighttime can be a time of feasting too, that light and dark are not simply opposites, that light and night interpenetrate like the stars that the prophetic book of Daniel describes in Daniel chapter 12. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Nighttime is mystery. It is filled with the unknown. We want to shine a light on it, get all the danger out of the way, or at least be able to see it coming. We who have physical sight have a lot to learn from people who move through this world without sight. Did you ever take a trust walk, maybe at camp? Put on a blindfold and trusted a friend to guide you down a path? We give up control in the dark, in the night, with a blindfold. And the nighttime feasting of Ramadan is like bright stars in our night. Breaking bread together is what we do as people of faith to build community, to foster trust, to feed our physical hunger after a long day of fasting, to feed our spiritual hunger for wisdom, for purpose, to feed our emotional hunger for intimacy. And still, breaking bread is no guarantee. Along with the horror of the murders in Orlando, along with the unthinkable 280 people killed with one truck bombing in Baghdad, this Ramadan, we witnessed the terror of murder in Medina, one of Islam's holiest cities. As night settled and Muslims began their iftar feast, friends invited a stranger walking past to join them breaking bread, and instead, he detonated the bomb he was wearing and killed all of them. Like the Christians who welcomed Dylan Roof into their Bible study at Mother Emmanuel Church in Charleston, and he killed 9 of them with a gun. I was talking with one of you this week about all of this terror and how, as people of faith, we still turn to one another, still bless and break bread together, and we asked rhetorically if we need metal detectors for our communion service this morning. Of course, we are choosing to trust. In a week, in a month, in a year, in a world that is filled with suspicion, we're choosing to bless and break bread together because we gather in the name of Jesus, and he told us to do this in remembrance of him. When we talk about carrying Christ's light into this world, I recall that light is a spectrum. It's not all or nothing. We might forget that because we live in a wild, wired world, and we can flip light switches to suddenly fill a room with light. But when Jesus was walking on this earth, light did not work that way. Light came with oil lamps and candles and torches, and the stars and the moon were bright at night, just like they are at the top of our lane near Huntington, without city lights dulling their shine. When we bless and break and share bread for our bodies and souls, we are not flipping a light switch. We are carrying a lamp. We don't gather as church and suddenly redeem all the horrors of our lives. We gather and light our lamps and kindle one another's flames. And when we come together, our lights shine brighter than they ever could alone. It will have to be enough for today to gather together and stoke one another's light as we will set back out into this aching world. And we do that with the bright lights of our joy and by sharing the sorrows that keep us up at night. I have just begun to journey with you. We're still getting to know each other. And you're celebrating with Philip and with me today as we prepare for our wedding. And you're grieving with us today as we mourn our beloved friend Oliver. And we are here with you to celebrate the brightest of your joys and the darkest of your sorrows. We grieve with you. I wish I could preach a sermon for you today that would make sense of all of this outrageous violence we're living with. All I can do is look for hope glimmering like a candle flame and hold it up to you and ask you to hold up your hope too. And first, I had to tell you about Oliver, because I am consumed by that raw grief. So what's the gift? Where is hope glimmering in my grief? Well, I'm not comparing Oliver to the people who have been killed this week. There's no comparison. It's a greater tragedy when a person is murdered than when our beloved dog is hit by a truck. But grief is grief. And what I can tell you about my grief is that I don't get to hide it in anything else. There is no one to be mad at. Nobody messed up. Oliver had never run down the lane before. We had no idea we should protect him from that possibility. The man driving the truck couldn't see him. He darted out of the beautiful thick trees on Cold Spring Road. There is no one to blame. And there's no legislation to pass. This was an accident. We don't need to widen the road or lower the speed limit. The deer might appreciate it. I would appreciate it as I bike on Cold Springs Road. But Oliver's death was an accident. So I can't hide my grief in guilt, and I can't hide it in anger, which means that my grief will work. It will work on me. We are divinely designed to grieve. Grief works on us. And sometimes we get stuck. In my years of chaplaincy, we call this complex grief. When grief is tied up with something else, it's usually anger or guilt. When it's tied up and complicated, grief can't just work on us because we have to tease it all apart and work on the anger and work on the guilt too. So I ask you, how is your grief working on you these days when you hear about the latest killing of a black man who was pinned down by police? How is your grief working as you hear about police officers shot by a man with a sniper rifle? Are you angry? Are you guilty? I am. We grew up with racism and militarism, and we can't flip a light switch and chase all those monsters back under the bed. It's not just a month worth of killings to undo. We have to deal with guilt and anger and despair from generations of white privilege, generations of racial injustice, generations of putting our trust in weapons rather than relationships. What does the light of Christ mean to us today? We can only flicker Christ's light as little candles, gathering together to bless and break and share bread, and still it is ours to do this day. We read in Proverbs chapter 4, "The path of the righteous is like the light of dawn that shines brighter and brighter until the full day." Our faith won't simply or quickly fix the ache we're living with. We're not here with a light switch. We are here with the songs of our faith, the rituals of our church, the prayers we share, guiding us on the path toward hope.